Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:59 p.m. That is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 8th. Today being Friday, of course, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. And this has been really quite an eventful week on the news front. But I really do want to concentrate on the longer term in this particular video. So I want to kick off by looking at the velocity of money, because I really don't think that there is any coincidence that the velocity of money peaked back in 1997. I think there is no better graphic illustration of the disintermediation that's been associated with the internet since the late 1990s. And that disruptive influence on the economy continues today. And I was reminded of that when I saw this article that came through from LinkedIn. And when we look at LinkedIn, or at least this article, Amazon is spawning a new industry. But what it is in fact telling us is that that brands are coming under fire because what they are largely trading on is their good name, and they charge a substantial premium for that good name. But companies that would once have been fabless or OEM manufacturers are now simply going direct to consumer, and Amazon is facilitating that. And that is contributing to this disintermediation effect. I'll give you, a personal example was, I remember when I first moved to the UK, I bought my first TV. And it was the biggest large screen CRT that they had back in the year 2000. And I remember it costing £300. So it was the biggest cheap one. But I remember it was about 4 or 5 years later, a fuse went in the back of it, and I opened it up, and it was in fact manufactured by Sanyo. That was not what was written on the label at the front. I remember clearly that the label at the front said Mitsui, Mitsui. But if I had wanted to buy a Sanyo television, which would have been exactly the same, then I would have had to pay maybe 3 or 4 times more. But because I took the no-name brand, which was exactly the same under the hood, but without the moniker on the front, then I got a substantial discount. And that was only on a small scale. But what Amazon is now doing is affording companies that are manufacturing products for much larger enterprises the ability to scale their operations by going direct to consumer. And what we've also seen is we get, in my wife's business at least, gets emails really quite regularly talking about where you can get customer service, and that they're offering customer service in Mandarin now. And of course, the only reason that they're offering customer service in Mandarin is because they are trying to appeal to manufacturers in China to sell directly to consumers all over the world. And by their, and basically what they're doing is cutting out the middleman. They're going directly factory to consumer and acting as the intermediary between and picking up the so therefore, Amazon is turning into one of the biggest brokers that the world has ever seen. And that is why the share price is continuing to march higher. And we can see that there is a staircase step sequence uptrend, particularly since the beginning of 2015. And that was when the company made a clear decision that it was no longer going to be the lowest possible cost, and that has certainly been the case, that you can shop around and get a better price now than you can on Amazon, but not for every product, and the ease and the level of customer service that you get from Amazon has ensured that they have got hundreds of millions of people that have subscribed, and upwards of 100 million people now have Prime. So we're getting some pause and consolidation around 1200, but as long as it is holding this staircase step sequence uptrend, then I suspect that the market is going to be willing to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But what this is also is a dramatic, I think, illustration of is the disinflation that we get with technological innovation. And in that disinflation, there are the seeds for the next inflation. I think that that is something that is completely unappreciated, that it is the essence of the master-slave dialectic that we see from Hegel over 300 years ago, which has been used by people to describe passive and, or I guess, dominant and submissive relationships in various different sectors and areas of life. The disintermediation that we get, and the fact that the velocity of money has been trending lower, has deflationary effects on the technology sector in particular, and that they pick up the margin by cutting out the middleman in an increasingly large number of sectors. That is where the great threat to employment comes from the technology sector. But therein lies the problem, because what we've had over the last 30-odd years has been the trend of globalization, where companies have been able to move their manufacturing offshore, to streamline their operations, to create this just-in-time manufacturing process, and that trend is gaining pace, that we're getting industrial automation, which is creating the potential for factories to be completely automated. And that is most particularly becoming a threat in the textile sector, where we're seeing that the sewing industry is becoming progressively more automated, that large numbers of companies, particularly in Southeast Asia and China, are looking to automate completely within the decade. And where they can't automate, they're already moving to low-cost jurisdictions, not least in Africa. But what that is also going to contribute to is this disinflationary impact. But what we are beginning to see the beginning of, at least the first signs of, is a recoil from globalization, most particularly from voters in the West. The very fact that you've had globalization has led to the rise of the global middle class. It has afforded the opportunity for hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people to be lifted out of poverty and into the middle classes. But that has happened not without cost, and the cost has been borne by the middle classes in North America and Europe, and most particularly. And we've had the evolution of the Rust Belt, and you can say that in just about every country. And because of the accelerating pace of technological innovation, what is happening is we're getting this reaction against the status quo, where the justification for globalization, which is in large part twofold, one being that we will have cheaper consumer goods, and therefore you will be able to get more by spending less, has not worked out for a lot of people, because the net effect has been that wages have gone nowhere, because you were going to be expected to get more with less, so therefore there was no need to demand higher wages because of lower consumer prices. But that did not stop the cost of services in all these countries rising. So the cost of education, the cost of insurance, and the cost of healthcare have continued to trend higher. And obviously also the cost of pensions have also trended higher, so that the quantity of tax that is taken out of people's paychecks in order to fund the state sector has continued to increase. So those are important characteristics that are leading towards this backlash against the status quo. And we're seeing it as in terms of the rise of populism, xenophobia, racism, nationalism. And it is being manifested in different ways in different countries. So we've had the rise of populism in North America with the election of President Trump and his commitment to have some form of tax reform. Now, quite whether that is going to, I think, give the people what they want, which is more money in their pockets, remains open to question. Whether the tax reform that is in fact delivered is what people want, is going to remain an open question until we exactly see the form that it takes within the next couple of weeks. But the market has priced in a lot of good news. And when we look at some of the major indices, not least the Nasdaq 100, there is a mild overextension relative to the trend mean. Approximately 400 points on a 6,400 point index is not a very large overextension. But it does suggest that we are due some pause in consolidation. The pace of the advance has certainly picked up, and it will need to continue to hold the progression of higher reaction lows and find support in the region of the trend mean in order for us to continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. But because what we're getting in North America is a populist response to this issue of the hollowing out of the middle class, then what in fact it represents is a fiscal bump following what has already been an impressive recovery off the 2008 lows. This is the very definition of a pro-cyclical strategy. What it therefore suggests is that we're going to have a boom, that the boom could last for a year or two, but then subsequently we'll have a bust. And more than likely, that will be in response to higher interest rates. The federal funds rate is currently 1.25%. And this is still really quite low. It's expected to rise by another 25 basis points next week, so it'll take it up to 1.5%. Now, we can see very clearly that there is a progression of lower rally highs on this particular index. And when we look at the 10-year bond yield against which mortgages are priced off of, then we could also see this long-term progression of lower rally highs, albeit in a much more volatile manner. And in order to really consider that this bull market in bonds and downtrend in yields has ended, then that progression of lower rally highs will need to be broken, and broken emphatically. But what we can see clearly from this long-term chart is that yields have already been going sideways since about 2011, and that the yield today is pretty similar to where it was back in 2008, which is not far off of 10 years ago. So this is already an evolving base formation, and it is hard to imagine that the yield is going to go very much lower. In fact, I think it is a pretty sound bet that the lows are in for this downtrend. Then the question is, how long is it going to take before inflationary pressures kick up? Because when we still have these low interest rates, despite the fact that they are rising at a very moderate pace, and we have people asking for more wages and expecting, or if they're not getting wages, they're expecting to get a tax cut, which is more money in their pockets, and virtually almost certainly going to result in a larger deficit, then eventually that is going to contribute an economic headwind. But the potential is that we are now entering the third psychological perception stage of the bull market, that there is a growing consensus that the best way to participate in this bull market is via passive investing. So there were articles this week talking about the dominance that both BlackRock and Vanguard have in the ETF sector. And as of today, they manage in excess of $11 trillion. And there are estimates that by the mid-2020s that will be $20 trillion. And that's even in today's inflated money, or I guess deflated money environment. This is still a lot of money. But what it also means is that investors are no longer doing their own research. They are betting on a momentum play, that by simply betting on the index and not betting on a fundamental value basis, then what you are in fact doing is betting on momentum. And there are a number of reasons for that. The vast majority of indices are market cap weighted. Therefore, the largest companies tend to occupy the largest weightings. When the largest companies are doing well, then their weighting increases and they drag the index higher. By the same token, the smaller companies represent a smaller weighting. And when a company eventually tops out, the greatest impact that it has on the index is when it begins to deteriorate. The longer it deteriorates for, the lower its market cap is, and the less of an influence it has on the overall index. So the diminishing impact of losers and the improving or increasing impact of winners tends to create a momentum move in stock market indices, which is why they do also tend to accelerate, despite the fact that they are made up of hundreds of different constituents. And the fact that people are willing to bet on the index without doing their fundamental analysis of the constituents of the index, and obviously any index will be made up of sound companies, mediocre companies, and pretty, I think it would be unkind to call them nefarious, but there are definitely companies that survive on leverage and not much more. And by buying the index, you get all of them. But what you're in fact getting are the momentum plays, the ones that are doing best and that are largest will have the greatest impact on the index. And with $11 trillion, I think, contributed to this kind of strategy, that's a lot of money. And what it also means is that as long as those winners are continuing in reasonably consistent trends, there's probably not a great deal to worry about. But when we think about the ability of the market to continue to rally, when we eventually do get companies like Amazon and, I guess, really to think about the FANGs, it would be Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Alphabet are the primary ones that have got these consistent trends and that remain reasonably consistent. Where I think you have the canary in the coal mine are going to be companies like Netflix and Tesla and Uber. Because these are the kinds of companies that are incredibly popular, they are very large, and they don't make any money. And Tesla, in particular, loses money on every single car. And yet, its share has rallied from about $12 to $300. And it is pausing here around the $300 area. And this is a big level for Tesla, that they are still a long way from making money. And that is representative of some of the risks that are outstanding in this particular market. So, if Tesla were declining in a big way, that would also be representative of some risk coming into the high yield market. And we don't have that right now. That's something that I think is rather important. That if we were seeing that high yield spreads were widening out in a big way, then that would be representative of trouble for the stock market. But that is not the case. In fact, what we're actually looking at is an environment where high yield spreads have been almost completely inert for a long time. So there is nothing there to suggest yet that we have a problem with the passive investing strategy. And in fact, it is passive investing, which is the very definition of buy and hold, is characteristic and is often the best strategy during a bull market phase. It is when you get the breakdown in consistency characteristics that one has to question the buy and hold strategy. But it isn't the only earnings agnostic strategy out there. a lot of hedge funds have engaged in risk parity strategies, which is laying off equity risk against fixed income risk. And that has been possible because of the low volatility environment. So when we look at the VIX index, the fact that it has been trending lower for much of the last 3 years has contributed to this very inert environment. And you can see that it is back below 10 again this week, that we had some intraday spikes, but that every time it has pushed up to a spike, even on an intraday basis, it has pulled right back down below 10 again. And there is the meaningful potential that it could move right down now and take out the lows that we saw in November. So this is, I think, an important characteristic here, that a lot of the passive investing and risk parity strategies, and indeed quantitative strategies are in fact using the relationship between low volatility and the consistency on the stock market to generate yield by shorting the VIX. They're treating it as a yield vehicle in the absence of buying bonds. But again, these are momentum strategies, and momentum strategies work wonderfully in beautifully consistent trends. They are the ideal strategy in a market that is just going up and is not pulling back in a dramatic fashion. And because they work, because they have the benefit of a few years of history, then that is encouraging additional investors to put their money in. And there was news also this week that we had a surge in retail investors. And I'll just pull this over so that you can see it. Retail investors just made an historic move into US stocks, and that was from 2 days ago. So what we're starting to see is people are picking up the pace. And what that suggests is that we are moving into the third psychological perception stage of this bull market. And when we look at what that can look like, we should really look at some of the big bull markets that we've had. And I'm just simply going to take a broad market index like the S&P 500. Because even from the 1990s, from 1995 to 1999, it more than doubled. And that was already after an impressive bull market. Now we've had a very impressive breakout. We had the first big consolidation, and now the market is moving progressively higher. I think it is only fair to look at it on a logarithmic scale chart to give us some real perspective, because this has been a phenomenally impressive breakout, and there is absolutely no indication that it is over. The fact that the index has broken out of one of these very long-term ranges means that we are back in a secular bull market. So when I say that we are entering the third psychological perception stage, it is only for that period of the bull market between 2008 and now that we could quite easily see an acceleration, and then we get a pause, and probably even a recession at some point in the next few years, and then the bull market resumes. We can see from the Dow Gold Ratio over 100 years that there are approximately 36 years between the peaks, and the last peak was in 1999. We had a more than decade-long secular bull market in gold, and now we're back in a secular bull market for equities, which tend to be much lengthier. And the next major peak in this ratio could be somewhere around 2035. And considering that we are now coming to the end of 2017, that suggests that there is another 17 years of a bull market relative to the gold price for the Dow Jones. And if that is indeed the case, then if we assume that gold prices will hold the $1,000 area, and I know that that is a big assumption. We certainly don't know what the potential is. But that would suggest that the Dow Jones doubles in the next 15 years. And that's a meaningful move, considering that it is now at 22,450, 405, excuse me. Now, when we look at it on that basis, it has gone up a lot. And there is the potential that it will go up more before we get a meaningful pullback. One of the most important characteristics about the trend just in the very short term is how shallow the reactions have been. Now, I closed out my long in the Dow Jones, excuse me, I closed out my short in the Dow Jones today because I don't think that it is going to break down below 24,000, and I was using the short as a hedge against my long on the Nikkei. I do think that we are going to continue to see the technological innovation trend persist because it works independently of the markets. The pace of technological innovation isn't influenced to any great extent by how much money is moving in and out of the sector. The valuations of those companies, on the other hand, is heavily influenced by how much money is coming in and out of the sector. The big change that we are getting right now is the rise of the reaction against the status quo. And I've already spoken about it in the USA being represented by populism. Then the reaction in the UK has been to get out of the EU and look for more independence. And with the at least the signing of a deal in here today by Theresa May, what it really suggests is that the UK is probably going to remain quite a bit closer to the EU than a lot of the people who voted to get out would really like, and probably not quite as close as a lot of the people who voted to remain would like. That it is somewhere in between. There is going to have to still be a lot of negotiation. But if we go back and look at exactly what it is that the UK wanted and what the EU demanded, the UK has pretty much caved on every point. And what that suggests is that it is going to be more difficult to get out of the EU. That the UK is probably going to end up with a relationship with the EU quite a bit closer than a lot of people were envisaging from the beginning of the negotiations. But what that was also greeted by in here today was a rally in stocks. And the FTSE 100 has completed a 17-year range and continues to consolidate above 7,000. This is just the beginning of a new bull market. And as long as it is holding that 7,000 area, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. And if you loop the UK into everything that is going on in Europe, then the Europe Stoxx 600 has been ranging below 400 for 17 years already and is pushing back up towards that level once more. It suggests that Europe has the potential to play catch up with what is going on in the USA. We are already seeing that we're getting the beginnings of some revolt happening inside the EU, that there are that France has voted for Macron, who in many respects was a completely unknown quantity, and hoping that he would be able to change some of the things in the economy that were contributing to this hollowing out of the middle class. And we will see what he can deliver on. Angela Merkel was really had her knuckles wrapped by the electorate for welcoming in 2 million refugees and is still trying to form a government. We're going to have an election in Italy, and there is the potential that it is going to go up, that it is going to come down to the wire. And we'll see again what happens there. Then we have, I think, continued moves in Spain, in Portugal, and then also in the Czech Republic, in Hungary, in Poland, in Turkey, that what's happening in China and how the Xi regime is going to change their economy, it remains open to question. When we look at the Chinese market, I think that one of the problems with looking at various stock market indices is that they're dominated by the largest banks, for example. And some of the problems are in the unlisted banking sector, so it's not reflected in the stock market indices. When we look at, for example, the Chinese government bonds, then we can see that there is not a great deal of worry in there, despite the fact that yields have moved up pretty aggressively over the last few months. They're still within this very long range, where we do get a bit of volatility between the 2.5% and 4.5% levels, and that's been the case for 10 years already. But that doesn't suggest that there's anything, any imminent problem. And the currency itself is, I think, heavily manipulated would probably be the best way to characterize it. So then, what is it that we can use to look at China as a bellwether? Because one of the issues that we're seeing in the West is that populations are voting for change. They're rebelling against the status quo. But with automation, with the aging of the population, and with the fact that China has built up a great deal of debt, people don't have a vote. And therefore, what is the administration going to do to hold on to power? That's an awfully big question. That is something that we can be sure the Chinese are also asking. So what we have already seen since the Party Congress has been that the big private sector companies are being ordered and influenced by what is deemed necessary by the administration. So they have to toe the party line, and that is absolutely something that they are going to be forced to do. What that is contributing to, for example, with a company like Baidu that has got a lot of expertise in artificial intelligence, it will be probably the number one provider for the Chinese market, but as only so long as it toes the party line. They're also actively moving what are considered low-class people out of Beijing, and because not only because they've been living in squalor, and but also because they represent a potential source of problems if the economy turns downwards. The fact that you have an authoritarian regime that permits capitalism, but on its own terms and only insofar as it is subservient to the socialistic cause, that has very strong correlations with fascism. So rather than thinking about China as a communist state or an authoritarian regime, I think perhaps the better way to think about it is as a fascist regime. And fascist regimes can be positive for their stock markets, provided their natural proclivity towards outright and rampant nationalism are curtailed. That is a big challenge for somewhere like China, where they are building a blue water navy, where they do want to compete and have a world-class military that is the equal of the USA. That is an awfully large question. If we really are thinking about the long term, not so much about the next few months or years, but if we were thinking about it in terms of decades, then this is a potential issue with China, that it will want to exercise its military muscle in the same way that it is doing with its economy. And I think that that is a potential problem for something somewhere out there on the horizon. It's also part of the reason why we have this continued advance in the military industrial complex. What this continues to price in is the automation of the military industrial complex, that it is less about boots on the ground and more about technology in the air that is contributing to the continued rise of defense spending, not just in the USA, but just about everywhere. Now, these are important themes. We are still in, I think, when we think about the rise of inflation and the continued disinflation, what these are obviously competing themes. And because they are competing, it means that they have to be considered in just about every sector and every asset class, and whether one is winning out over the other, depending on what the particular influences are on a particular country or a particular region or a particular sector or asset class. So there is no simple, easy answer. But what we can think about is that there is a lot of debt. That the US Treasury's quantity of debt has doubled since 2008. And since that is the case, then the amount of money required to service the debt is also larger. I think that that is quite obvious. Well, if that's the case, then the sensitivity to interest rates is going to be higher, and therefore the interest rate at where problems may arise will probably be lower. So therefore, we really do need to watch things like the unemployment rate. We need to watch the high yield spreads, and we need to monitor the consistency of trends, because we will have a recession at some point if we are moving out of the most benign possible environment where every central bank is being accommodative, and we're moving into a period of time where they're not all as accommodative. Then eventually we will get to a point where fewer of them are accommodative. Right now, the Federal Reserve is the only bank that has been raising interest rates. Eventually, the UK will probably be the second one, and the ECB is beginning to talk about beginning to talk about the tapering of its quantitative easing program. And the ECB is the only central bank where we have an example of a reduction in the size of its balance sheet, and it created a sharply deflationary outcome for the European economy in 2013 and 2014. And it really wasn't until they reversed course and even rolled back on the fiscal austerity that things started to pick up in Europe. And the European economy is firing on all cylinders right now. It is pretty much the Goldilocks scenario. That's what we have in the US. That's what we had in the US. That's what we have in Europe, and most and also in Japan, where they're running both easy monetary and fiscal policy. So eventually that will change, and it will lead to a recessionary outcome. But if I'm correct that we are moving out of a secular period of disinflation, then and the I guess where we have the most graphic representation of that is in Japan. Because Japan had an enormous bubble in the 1980s. And subsequently, it went through a deflationary bust. And the yield right now is 5 basis points on the 10-year JGB. And back in 1990, the yield was at 8%. Now, I hope that we can go back further than that on the Bloomberg history. Unfortunately, that's as far back as it goes to 1987. But this has been a pretty profound downtrend. Now, if we are in fact moving into an inflationary outcome, well, the TOPIX index has been ranging below about 1750, or let's call it 1800, for an awfully long time. And it is now testing the upper side of that range. And I'm just going to update this chart. It's not all the way up to the current day. It's right at the upper side of this range. Now, every single time it has got up to this range, the upper side of this range, it has pulled back and made a new low. And that changed in 2015. It pulled back, but it did not make a new low, and now we are at a new rally high. Now, we could have some consolidation in this area, but as long as it holds and then improves upon that performance, we're back in a secular bull market for Japan. And I think an enormously big question is what do you, I guess the big question then is if Japan tried everything in one of the greatest periods of disinflation in history and failed, then since they've been so exaggerated in what they have been trying, if we are moving back into a global inflation cycle, then it could be one of the first places where we begin to see signs of inflation recurring. And the fact that the stock market is now breaking higher, I think, is representative of that. And because we know that those bond yields have been so incredibly low, that's been an incredible headwind for the banking sector because they haven't been making any margin. But we can see that the banks were considered really depressed back in 2003, and then they had a storming rally, and they went from about 100 to 500 in the space of about 2 years, and then they gave up the entire advance and made new lows, and they've been ranging below 200 for 3 years already. If Japan is moving back into an inflationary cycle, that's about as bullish as you can imagine for the banking sector, because there is the potential that yields will begin to rise. That would put downward pressure on the yen, so it would boost nominal prices in for equities, and it would raise the possibility that we could have higher interest rates. Now, we are a long way from higher interest rates in Japan because they're still running quantitative easing programs, and they haven't even begun to taper. They're only beginning to talk about tapering their quantitative easing program. The one thing that we know you get from quantitative easing is asset price inflation, and that's certainly what we're beginning to see now in Japan's stock market. The one sector that is not yet participating is the banking sector, and I think that is about to change. What one of Abe's commitments was to list the Post Bank, and here is Japan Post Insurance, where it is now breaking up and out of this very inert period that it has had since the decline immediately following its IPO. And this is the Post Bank, and it hasn't quite yet broken out of its range, but this does look like a first step above the Type 2 bottom. So what we're beginning to see is large cap banks beginning to look a little bit more positive. And what that suggests to me is that we are beginning to see the first signs of inflation starting to come back in Japan, and that will have a profound impact on that market because they just don't remember what it's like to have inflation since the last time they had an inflationary spiral was in the late 1980s. So this is, I think, a big change that technological innovation is going to continue to have a disinflationary impact, but that because of the hollowing out of the middle classes, that we're going to start to see wage demands rising. And that wage could be in many different forms. It needn't necessarily be payroll, but it will represent a demand for more money in the pockets of consumers. Now, when we think about that in terms of the commodity complex, when we go back and think about China, because I think I got a little bit derailed. The resources sector is heavily dependent on Chinese demand growth. Not simply Chinese demand, but Chinese demand growth. And what that is, I think, more representative of is the mining sector. So when we look at the currency or we look at the stock market or the banks, I don't think that they're particularly representative of what is in fact going on in China. But the mining sector is, because they sell their products directly to China. And the mining sector is bouncing in here today from the region of the trend mean. It has been on a recovery trajectory since the beginning of 2016, and as long as it is holding, the region of the trend mean, I don't think that there's going to be a lot to worry about with what's going on inside the Chinese market right now. Now, there are obviously very big themes that are winding their way through the markets. And of course, the first of them is demographics, because we have the potential for 2 billion additional consumers coming into the global economy over the next couple of decades, and that is going to drive demand for just about everything, but most particularly in places like Asia and Africa. That's where the bulk of the population growth is going to be. And governance will absolutely have to improve, because otherwise what you're going to end up with is famine. And if governance improves, then you get internal demand, you get exports, and you get people being able to benefit from compound interest, both in terms of their savings and also by investing in capital assets. If you have famine, you have disease, and you have the breakdown of society, capital assets get destroyed, and savings get eroded by inflation. So what happens in terms of the governance in various African countries is going to have a big impact on whether that entire continent is going to, I think, improve and rise to the potential challenges that are coming from their demographic dividend. And that's also the case for India, where we have plenty of evidence of improving governance over the last few years under Modi's rule. And we're seeing now that the Nifty is pulling away from this 10,000 area, but it has held a pretty persistent advance since the beginning of this year. And as long as it is remaining reasonably consistent, we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Reliance Industries launched the 4G back at the beginning of this year. I think it was really the end of last year. And when it finished that investment cycle, the share has done nothing but move higher, and this is one of the biggest shares on the index. So that is contributing to the continued outperformance of the index. Now, the other one is Tata Consulting. And Tata Consulting has been one of the primary beneficiaries of offshoring, and it hasn't done anything for 4 years. So that is going to have to break up and out of this range to lend an additional tailwind to the Indian market. But what we have here are two different pictures. One is benefiting from internal demand. The launch of 4G is a, I think it's a seismic event for the Indian market, whereas the trend of offshoring is something that has probably already played out, and they're going to have to do more with less in order to grow it further. This is something that depends on globalization, and most particularly, it is the moving of jobs overseas. Rather than I think the established roots of globalization, this is more the white collar globalization, and the share has done nothing for 4 years, suggesting that this is already a pretty mature trend. Then, of course, we have the revolution that's going on in energy, and the oil price is continuing to sustain this move above $60. What I think the biggest change that we've had has been what's happening in the shale drilling sector, because their investors are telling them that they want their money back, that the with it, rising interest rates, this is having an effect on the shale oil drillers. Shale oil requires constant drilling. Those drills are expensive, and the technological prowess of these companies is improving all the time, and they're able to bring down the costs. But nonetheless, unconventional wells are more expensive than conventional wells, and They've been extended a lot of credit, and now they're having to pay back some of that in the form of dividends. And what that is contributing to is a somewhat higher oil price, and not least because OPEC, it continues to cut back on their demand, excuse me, on their supply. It, on a very technical basis, it has cleared that $60 level, which has been an area of resistance, and as long as it is holding the move above $60, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside in the short term. Well, in the medium term, $100 represents really quite a big psychological level, and it's unlikely that we're going to see, I think, that level surmounted for any kind of lengthy period. The most important chart out there in terms of oil is the very long-term chart. And when we look at that on a very long-term basis, and indeed on a log scale, then what we are presented with is, and I need to go back longer than that. Sorry, I can't type and chew gum, I'm afraid. So there we go. Now I can just go back and look at 100 years of history. And what we get are these ranges, one above another, that oil prices can go sideways for decades, and then you have a big bull market. Well, they went up a lot in the 2000s, and now they're going sideways. And the likelihood is that the upper side of that range is around $100, and it will probably take geopolitical events to get us up to that level. But then supply increases, and we come back down. And it isn't that there is any dearth of supply from unconventional sources, but rather it is somewhat more expensive. And that's also what this chart tells us, is that you get a rising cost of marginal production coming through, and that contributes to this rangy environment. And battery technology is improving all the time. It's probably not increasing at quite as fast as a lot of people are really enthused about, but it is improving all the time. And I think economies of scale argument is going to become progressively more important as we get more gigafactories being opened up, most particularly in Asia, over the next 4 and 5 years. So what that is right now contributing to is the supply inelasticity meets rising demand environment for lithium. And we could have the same situation evolving in nickel if the LME splits the contract into the lower quality nickel and higher purity nickel that is required for batteries. But all of these factors, what they contribute to is that energy prices are unlikely to be a major headwind to economic growth in future. And that's foundational for the perspective that we are in a secular bull market. So when I think about all the things that we're watching, that it's because we're starting to see the pace of it, of the advance picking up. And what that generally tells us is that we are entering the period where I think irrational forecasts for future potential will become more common. And that's when we need to be most vigilant. The next recession is likely to give us a buying opportunity that will be good for at least the decade afterwards. So having some cash on the sidelines when markets start to roll over is probably going to be a good idea. And that is most particularly the case right now for Bitcoin, because that is where we see evidence of the most vociferously bullish people. That we're having people that have been minted as millionaires and even billionaires this year because the price has gone up so much. So, considering that it was at 4,000 at the end of September and it is at 15,644 the day before, or at least 2 days before, futures start trading, suggests that this has been a profound acceleration. And there isn't a great deal of evidence just yet that it's over. But in an accelerating market where people have made a lot of money very quickly, and where there is a real belief that the market will, or that Bitcoin could actually displace government-backed currencies. That's indicative of a contradiction in the market, and every major bull market has a contradiction. Bitcoin is not going to overtake conventional currencies. It is completely out of the realm of banks, of central banks, to change the volume of. They can't simply create it out of nothing. It's energy intensive, it's slow, it requires peer-to-peer, and it's also easily stolen. There is a long list of things that, and of course, its volatility precludes it from being a viable currency. So the very fact that it is called a cryptocurrency is a misnomer. In fact, we are also—I mean, it's occurred to me this week that we are in a period of time where a new speak from 1984 has become de rigueur. That a cryptocurrency is not a currency. That there are a number of different, I think, words that are used in modern language that are not fit for purpose, and they contribute to this environment that that contributes to people having faith. So when we talk about status and Facebook likes and these sorts of terms, they mean nothing in terms of what's happening in the real world. The reality here is that Bitcoin has rallied spectacularly, and there isn't a great deal of evidence that it is over, but we're getting the introduction of leverage on Sunday. So there has been a lot of good news priced in, and there have been a lot of people buying it in anticipation of being able to sell later to all these new institutional investors. There is the reality that leverage also means shorting. So we are probably close to the next quite abrupt pullback. And we know that Bitcoin is liable to have these big pullbacks. I think that the $12,000 area is a big level for Bitcoin. What we have in terms of this trend is a series of ranges, one above another. And the most recent range was around 11,000. So maybe give it a little bit more, and 12,000 is a big psychological level. Even 10,000 is a big psychological level. But the big question is, what is this trend going to look like when it ends? Because it has already accelerated, and accelerations are often met with these very swift pullbacks. And in fact, a lot of people have been conditioned to think of those as buying opportunities. What would then be seen is a rebound. It would fail to sustain a high again, and then it would drop to a new low. Then we would have a top formation. So these are things to be, I think, keenly aware of as this weekend winds through, because the CBOT future is going to kick off on Sunday. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend and wish all the best to all of you.